as smart, fair, and open-minded, as someone who was willing to listen. For a SAC wing commander, he was well-liked. But Moser didn't know very much about Titan II missiles. He'd previously served as deputy director of missile maintenance at SAC headquarters and as the commander of missile maintenance at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. Those assignments, however, had required an extensive knowledge of Minuteman missiles, a completely different weapon system. The Minuteman used solid fuel, not liquid propellants. It was smaller than a Titan II with a less powerful warhead, and each Minuteman complex had 10 missiles, not one, with silos dispersed as far as 17 miles from the launch control center. A Minuteman crew could go months without visiting a silo. The Titan II was the only ballistic missile in the American arsenal that relied on liquid fuel and a combat crew living down the hall. It was a rare, exotic bird. Of the more than 1,000 long-range missiles that SAC controlled, only 54 were Titan IIs. Moser didn't pretend to be an expert on the Titan II, and from his first day in Little Rock had shown an eagerness to learn. 3 or 4 mornings a week, he attended pre-departure briefings for the launch crews and the PTS teams. He vowed to spend time at every launch complex before the end of the year. But some of the complexes were a long way from Little Rock, and he still hadn't visited them all. When Colonel James L. Morris arrived at the command post around 7 p.m., he already knew what had happened at the silo. Morris was the deputy commander for maintenance, and about half an hour earlier, he'd overheard Captain Mazzaro on the radio, sounding excited about something. Morris told Job Control to call 4-7 and ask Charles Heineman, the head of PTS Team A, what was going on there. Heineman said that Powell had dropped a socket into the silo and poked a hole in the missile. He said that Powell saw a lot of fuel vapor but no fire. Morris absorbed the news, told Job Control to track down Jeff Kennedy, and ordered the dispatcher not to contact the launch complex again. Within an hour of the accident, the pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank had dropped by about 80%. A vacuum was forming inside it as fuel poured out. If the pressure continued to drop, the tank might collapse. After Jeff Kennedy joined Morris in the command post, Colonel Moser briefed them on the situation and instructed them to head to 4-7 by helicopter. Morris would serve as the on-site commander, and Kennedy would help him find out what was happening, whether there was a fire, and what needed to be done. Before leaving Little Rock, Kennedy asked Job Control to call the launch complex and tell them to get a REFCO suit ready for him. "We've been ordered not to call the complex," the dispatcher said. "Bring your own." Kennedy didn't have time to gather the necessary gear. A helmet, a fresh air pack, a REFCO suit the right size, and left the base without it. The hazard team had come up with a plan. PTS technicians would re-enter the silo, vent the Stage 1 fuel tank, equalize the pressure, and prevent the missile from collapsing. Time was of the essence, and the re-entry had to be done as soon as possible. The PTS men topside had REFCOs and air packs and a full set of equipment in their trucks. Ideally, they'd go into the complex. But nobody knew where they were. After leaving the complex, they'd probably driven beyond the range of the radios in their helmets. And their trucks didn't have radios that could contact the base. If they wanted to speak with the command post, they'd have to drive to Damascus and use a payphone, or call from a nearby house. The PTS crew that had taken refuge in the control center would have to do the job, wearing the REFCOs left behind in the blast lock. Because their socket was now lying somewhere at the bottom of the silo, they'd have to remove the pressure cap on the Stage 1 fuel tank with pliers. And if that didn't work, they might have to push open the tank's poppet valve with a broom handle. Before Colonel Moser could approve the plan and set it in motion, SAC headquarters joined the discussion via speakerphone. It was about 7:45. The missile potential hazard net was finally up and running, and Lieutenant General Lloyd Levitt, the vice commander in chief of the Strategic Air Command, was on the line. Levitt made it clear that from now on, nothing would be done in the Launch Control Center, the silo, or anywhere else on the complex without his approval. And he would not authorize any specific action until a consensus had been reached that it was the right thing to do. Levitt was in his early 50s, short, compact, and self-confident. He'd been a member of the first class to enter West Point after the Second World War. While the heroism of that war was celebrated in popular books and films, his classmates were soon risking their lives in a conflict that was largely ignored by the public. Levitt became a fighter pilot and flew 100 combat missions during the Korean War. He routinely encountered enemy planes and anti-aircraft fire. During one mission, his F-84 was hit by flak and suffered an electrical failure. Levitt had to fly 250 miles without flight instruments or a radio before landing safely at an American base. During another, his plane spun out of control amid a snowstorm. Levitt had to bail out at 8,000 feet and felt lucky to be found by South Korean troops, not communist guerrillas. He later flew 152 combat missions in Vietnam. The two conflicts, as well as training flights, took the lives of many good friends. Of the 119 West Pointers who graduated from flight school with Levitt, 7 were killed in Korea, 2 in Vietnam, and 13 in airplane accidents. The odds of being killed on the job for his classmates was about 1 in 6. Some of Levitt's most dangerous missions occurred during peacetime. From 1957 to 1960, he flew U-2 spy planes. The U-2 was designed to fly long distances and take photographs at an altitude of 70,000 feet without being detected or shot down. In order to do so, the plane had to be kept as light as possible, and the small size of the pilot's survival kit imposed certain restrictions. Before leaving on a mission to photograph Soviet airfields and radar sites in Siberia, Levitt was given a choice: bring a life raft or a warm parka. He wasn't allowed to bring both. Levitt chose the parka, figuring that if he had to bail out over the Bering Sea, he'd freeze to death, with or without the raft. U-2 pilots flew alone, in a tiny cockpit, wearing cumbersome pressure suits and maintaining complete radio silence for as long as 9 hours. The plane was difficult to fly. It was fragile and stalled easily. Strong G-forces could break it apart mid-air. To save weight, it had only 2 sets of landing gear, one in the front and the other in the back.